Hi, everyone. It is Lunch Talk Live on a Tuesday here on NBCSN. Mike Tirico, glad that you are spending an hour with us. If you miss any of this hour or you've missed any of the hours that we've done for the last 10 weeks or so, they are available to you via podcast. Download them. Check out some interviews with some really good folks along the way. And in addition, our NBC Sports YouTube channel, you can go back and watch the show. Very good hour we have lined up for you. Hopefully we don't screw it up and execute it well. Among the guests in the hour, our colleague David Faraday from Golf Channel will join us. You'll never guess where he is. You'll find out in a moment. Brian Kelly, the head football coach at Notre Dame, Fighting Irish football players back on campus. The steps to returning to a proposed and hoped football season starting to take place. Tom Izzo, head basketball coach at Michigan State, 2000 national champion, will join us. What in the world is going on with Major League Baseball? Ken Rosenthal, one of the best, MLB Network, Fox, and The Athletic will join us. And Matt Dumba of the Minnesota Wild, defenseman, will join us. He is one of several NHL players in the news as we take you to the headlines. He's one of seven current and former players that are part of the Hockey Diversity Alliance, a mission to eradicate racism and intolerance in hockey. We will talk to Matt about what that initiative is in a little bit. Continuing with Bubba Wallace asking NASCAR and Confederate flags to be removed from NASCAR events as part of their continued conversation that reached about as high a volume as we've seen last week. Ken Rosenthal is going to join us to figure out some of the math behind what MLB is proposing, what the players want to do, and what's the deadline to get a season out there on the field. And golf is out there on the golf course at Colonial with the PGA Tour set to resume on Thursday with some of the biggest names. You'll see that on Golf Channel with the coverage on Thursday and Friday. For many, many years, our friend David Faraday has been part of the TV coverage at Colonial. He knows it really well. No better guest to have right now than David, who joins us from a beautiful, pastoral, splendid-looking location. Where are you and what are you doing?
Hey, good to talk to you, Mike. I am up on the Red, which is the border between Oklahoma and Texas, and I'm doing a little fishing.
You are. So you've completely run out of things to do. You're now hunting and fishing. Do you enjoy going out and doing fishing on a regular basis like this?
I fly fish, and you know, the Red River is, well, it's kind of red, oddly enough, and you know, I can see bubbles coming to the surface. The fish are pretty much laughing at me. Now, I don't do it very often, not often enough to be good at it.
But you're there, which is encouraging, gives you something to do. So we've interrupted Faraday's fishing trip to talk to him, which is great. David, it looks very hot there. You don't look like you're dressed very comfortably for what looks to me to be a scorching week in Texas.
Well, you know, I wear long sleeve shirts. I've been taking this opportunity where, you know, we're obviously not on the air to get some rebuilding done. And I've had some stuff burned off my arms, you know, precancerous stuff. I've had dental surgery. Basically, I'm undergoing a complete rebuild.
But you're okay. That's the key. The key news is that
fine. Yeah, nauseatingly okay, healthy.
Just want to make sure. for a man of your age, it's going to be like 100 degrees there at Colonial this week. That is not what the players are used to when they've played this golf tournament in the past.
No, that's true.
I think we might be losing David on the fishing trip. Yes, I think the fish have gotten David's signal. But we were looking at the weather just before, and Dave and I were talking during break. The temperature is 97, 98, 99, like 100 degrees for the 4 days at Colonial, much hotter than it usually is. They're usually there a month earlier in the month of May. Now, the players haven't been out much. Obviously, golf isn't the most strenuous activity for the PGA Tour players when somebody's caddying for them, yet the hot weather will be a significant factor in the golf course, how fast it plays. And also the players haven't done this in quite some time. The Charles Schwab Challenge is the first event in Fort Worth, and then they're going to ping pong around the country to Hilton Head, which is usually the week after the Masters. So they're going to play that event some 10 weeks later than they normally play. So the conditions at both of these courses are going to be a little different for the tour players than what they've become used to over the years. Then they'll go to Hartford, very close to the similar time that we see that event, for the Travelers Championship. And then they're going to come to Detroit for the second year of the Rocket Mortgage Classic at the Detroit Golf Club. And very interesting, we've heard a lot about dealing with the social injustices in different cities along the way. One thing at the Rocket Mortgage Classic, a lot of the money that is raised at that tournament is going to go to the digital divide, trying to bridge the gap of internet access in the city of Detroit. We saw that internet access was very important to a lot of folks as we moved to a work at home, work online mode. And that was one of the obvious changes that needed to be made. There is a gap in that space, and that's one of the things that that tournament will be addressing. So as the PGA Tour comes back, as it did with COVID-19 relief, we saw the TaylorMade driving relief, and then the event with Tiger and Phil and Brady, and of course, Peyton Manning, $26 million was raised for COVID-19 relief in those two events. And it just proves that golf is so philanthropic in so many ways. And you'll be seeing that at Colonial, then at Hilton Head, then in Hartford, and then the cause specifically that we just mentioned for the Rocket Mortgage Classic in Detroit. All right, we will get to David. We'll see if his fly fishing expedition has had any more success. So I guess we'll take a break here for a moment. And when we come back, we'll see if David Faraday's fishing expedition has found either success or found a better Wi-Fi signal. We'll be right back. Back on Lunch Talk Live continuing. So there's no fishtail here. This is an actual story. We've reconnected with David Faraday. David, what happened?
Well, believe it or not, my iPhone overheated, which gives you an indication of just what these players are going to go through this week. It's going to be torturous out there and very, very tricky. This is a golf course where Ben Hogan said, a straight ball will get you in more trouble here than anywhere else. So, it's going to be a challenge.
See, if people didn't think we were telling the truth about the temperature, we gave you Weather Channel like Jim Cantore in the middle of a hurricane reporting from David Faraday. David, to the players. Now, they have not played competitively. They've started playing golf on their own, maybe games with other PGA Tour pros, trying to keep a score. How different is it when you do flip the switch from just playing golf to now putting down a score on every hole and being a part of a PGA Tour event?
Well, this is almost twice as long as they would normally get on a winter break. And there's an itch here that a lot of these players are going to feel, and they're going to want to scratch it. That's for sure. They're dying to go. And there's a mixture of, certainly in the DFW area here of anticipation and frustration. The players are dying to go, and the spectators are dying to see it, but it's going to be very strange out there. It'll be a different experience for these players playing without a crowd. So, it wouldn't surprise me, Mike, if we have a surprise winner this week, maybe somebody from the Korn Ferry Tour.
That's the tour right below. Now, you say that. Is that, David, in part because the lack of crowds will maybe take off a little bit of the heat, the pressure, I should say, that guys are feeling on a Saturday and a Sunday over those last 5, 6, 7 holes?
Well, the last time most of these players played under these conditions was in college. That's why I bring up the Korn Ferry Tour, the recent graduates. They're closer to that than anybody else. But having no spectators is it's an unknown quantity, whether it'll be, more suspenseful for the players or less. There's the possibility there'll be less adrenaline. The short answer to that question is, I don't think anybody knows. This is such an experimental thing.
David, 1, 2, 3 in the world, Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, Brooks Koepka are all in the same group. Will that help them in any way create some atmosphere, just knowing that you're playing in elite groups? And there are a few of those stacked in the Thursday and Friday starting times.
Yeah, I think that's a terrific idea, having these top players in groups together. It'll provide a little bit of atmosphere there for sure that might be missing otherwise. And they're so competitive that they really want to beat each other. They're good friends. Despite, some of the things that you hear, reading newspapers or see on TV, Brooks is the one that sort of stands out there. But he's got an opinion. Boy, don't ask Brooks a question if you don't want the answer. But it'll be really interesting to see, I think, how they get on out there in these marquee groups.
Yeah, Ricky Fowler, Justin Thomas, number four in the world, and Jordan Spieth are going to be in the same group as well. Can we double back to Colonial just for a minute here? Because you spent so much time there. We know about the legacy of Ben Hogan and the history of that golf course. Not the longest test, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's an easy test. What makes Colonial so difficult?
It's a combination of, all the angles that they have out there. There's a lot of crosswinds, wind from the southeast, very warm. It's going to make fairways easy to miss. And when you hit it into this Bermuda rough, boy, it's one of those things that you get very seldom out there. When I played, you had to read a lie, whether it was going to be hot or slow. And with these square grooves and the new ball and that kind of thing, you don't really, generally speaking, you don't have to do that anymore on the PGA Tour. You know which way it's going to come out. This will be a different test, where they've got hot, chewy grass to try and chop it out of and guess which way the ball is going to go.
David, did you enjoy the time that you spent doing kind of what we're doing, working at home a little bit, creating some programming and some really interesting, other than me, very interesting guest for your Faraday show?
Yeah, I really have. It's so unusual for us. Mike, you've been traveling a long time as well. This is the longest time that I've spent without getting on an airplane in almost 50 years. And I have kind of enjoyed it. But it has given me a glimpse of what retirement might be like, which is something that I haven't really thought about very often until now. And it kind of frightens me, because I'm going to have to think of something to do. That's for sure. It's, I'm liable to go out of my gourd here, if it goes on for very much longer. Fortunately, we at NBC and Golf Channel wouldn't be working very much at this time of the year anyway. But I'm really looking forward to the playoffs, that's for sure, when we get back.
And all these guys are going to be playing a bunch between now and then, leading up to the FedEx Cup playoffs in the early fall, I guess it will be. David, thank you for hopping in your car, for getting cool. Stay safe out there. Truly the David Faraday hotline, as his phone overheated at the start of the show. But happy fishing, and we'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Thanks a lot, Mike. It's great to be with you.
Only Faraday. He's priceless. From the man from Northern Ireland to the head coach of the Fighting Irish, Notre Dame is in the news on the football front today as Irish football players arrive back on campus and get ready to start the process maybe towards playing in the fall. That's the goal, and first you got to get the guys there safely. And Brian Kelly, the head football coach at Notre Dame, actually has a team in one place together for the first time in months. And Brian joins us now. This is strange because usually, Brian, we're getting to this point of the summer where you get a chance to catch your breath for the season. I was starting to do the math. This is almost the ramp-up that's going to run all the way through, if you are playing football, hopefully to January.
That's true, Mike. Good to see you also. And certainly, talking about golf, with David Faraday, this is normally where I play a few rounds of golf and feel like I get competitive enough that I can talk about my golf game. That has not happened at all with all of these Zoom calls. You feel like you're plugged in all the time, but I'm going to be excited to watch a lot of golf on NBC and certainly because it is going to be different. We're going to have to crank this thing up because we've had virtually 3 months of inactivity with our football team. We didn't have a spring ball. We didn't have really formalized weight training and conditioning. So when we bring the team back, as you mentioned, safety, the health is at the forefront of what we do. But we're going to have to gradually get this football team back to a conditioning level that is really effective for playing this game of football. And it's going to take us a lot of time. And that means we have to be with this football team in July and in August to get them ready for September.
So let's walk folks through, Brian, what the NCAA allowed and then what Notre Dame started to do as your players got to a hotel there and then going to start the process of quarantine to get ready to start working out in small groups.
Yeah, so we'll be beginning that process next Thursday. So players that have to fly will need to be in a 7-day quarantine. They'll stay right on campus here at the Morris Inn Morris Inn has been kind of the hotel on campus that has taken care of our students, our international students that have been here on campus. So they're really good at having all the procedures and protocols in place. So it's going to be a great situation for our players as they come back. If you're driving, it's a 3-day quarantine. And then we'll all test on the 19th. I'm looking up at my calendar to make sure that I have the dates correct. But I'm in my office, my home away from office. So I've got whiteboards and things all over the place. But so as we work through this process, we want to put a football team in the weight room in conditioning that has tested entirely. And then we go to work on CDC protocols. You know, there'll be masks and distancing and sanitizing, and we'll have to make sure our meals fall through with those protocols. Coaches will have to do Zoom meetings as we work through three phases, 2 weeks each phase. As we get through that 2 weeks without any setbacks, we'll move to a second phase that gives us the opportunity to do more with larger groups and begin to interact more with our team. So there's a lot of work here. Our group has done an incredible job. Dr. Leisler, Rob Hunt, locally, we've had incredible help from the Cleveland Clinic, Johns Hopkins, to help us in this really unique time for all of us.
Now, the schedule has been bantied about a lot. Are there going to be non-conference games, a lot of travel? Obviously, the game with Navy that was scheduled for Ireland was moved back to Navy's campus, to Annapolis, which will be a first in the history, the long history of the Notre Dame-Navy series. Anything else on the schedule right now in question from where you sit on this day?
Well, as you know, we play in a lot of NFL stadiums right now, and so you know, what is the NFL's procedure relative? If you just look down the schedule right now, Wisconsin was, well, Wake Forest, starting with Wake Forest, that was scheduled to be played, you know, in an NFL stadium, you know. So where does that fall in terms of Panther Stadium, Wisconsin and Lambeau Field, Pitt at Pitt Stadium, Georgia Tech, you know, in Atlanta, at the Falcon Stadium. So what's the NCAA and what is the NFL doing relative to stadium capacity? Because those are large stadiums. And so, you know, you're sharing gates there. Do those go back on campus? I think Jack Swarbrick is you know, a lot of conversations as to whether those go back on campus or do they stay in NFL stadiums.
The conversation of playing football has seemed to be hand in glove, Brian, with kids being back on campus, because the conversation of separating the two was a non-starter for a lot of schools, some conferences. Notre Dame was at the forefront of that. There's been talk that maybe we'll see the students in the stadium to start with. Have you heard anything about that? So there's some sort of an atmosphere that you guys are playing with if things continue on this path as we get towards August and September.
You know, I think that's a fair assumption that I'm willing to make, and then I think that our administration is willing to make, that our students can be part of this. If they're going to be on campus, I think it's fair to say that students, faculty, staff, does that open it up to season ticket holders? I think everybody's looking at what the equation is and what the number is. And then, you know, I was forwarded a picture from, you know, during the Spanish flu, Notre Dame was playing Georgia Tech, and the pictures were everybody in the stands had masks on. So we've been down this road before. So if it requires those kinds of things, you know, that's what it's going to maybe take for the price of admission, if you will, to watch a football game this fall. And I don't know that that's such a heavy price to pay. So there are going to be some changes, certainly, in the landscape. But modern technology is filled in nicely with big jumbotrons. I think we can pump in some loud noise if we need to.
If you have to do that and just to change the atmosphere a little bit, just have some people there who I think will be at least a little bit more acceptable to folks who are watching on TV and hearing some natural reaction, and for the players and atmospherics as well. All right, the George Floyd death. He's being buried today in Houston. The conversation has been in every corner of the country, every aspect of our sports world. What's it been like in the Zoom calls with your players?
Well, I think that's where you start, right? You look at, first of all, getting the pulse of your football team. And our team was at first angry. They were confused. There were a lot of raw emotions, and you want to get those out and give your football team a platform where they can speak, they can talk, and most importantly, Mike, where they can be heard and then have actionable mm-hmm. things take place. We've started a unity council on our football team so we can begin to look at things within our own program that we can get better at, where I can be a better leader for our football team, and we can take on the systemic racism that exists in our country today, what we can do on campus as a football team and as a university. Look, we failed, and we have to come to grips with that. And so giving our players a voice, which we have through social media, giving them opportunities to understand where they can make a difference, whether it's in voter registration locally, whether it's being involved in more national events as well. But talking about it is the first step, but it can't be the last step. We have to have actionable things that we can put in front of our players and give them an opportunity. And I think that that's where it started with us in our first set of Zoom calls.
And it's such a unique place for this conversation because it's not just Notre Dame, but many private universities around the country have a very strong presence of Caucasian, of white students, and African-American students oftentimes are in a smaller percentage and are facing different challenges on that campus. And then you have the high-profile African-American students, like the athletes, who really are right in the forefront of being the most recognizable faces on campus. So I would imagine, Brian, that your players, especially your juniors and seniors, really can add to this conversation in a very unique way that's educational for the staff and for the white players on the team.
No, there's no doubt. And the juxtaposition of that too, Mike, is that our football team is 58% African-American and in a university mm-hmm. that is, 80-20. And so they can make a huge difference because they are the leaders of our football team. And so when they become leaders of our football team and are respected by everybody on our campus, that is a strong platform to come from. So we're encouraging them for their voice to be heard. And that resonates with them because they come to Notre Dame wanting their voice to be heard. So we're just providing them their opportunity for that to happen. And then giving them different platforms, whether it's, again, on our campus or off our campus, doing it together, doing it individually, all those things have to be available for our student athletes.
As we wrap, Brian, I'm just curious, all the COVID-19 stuff and all the protocols that football coaches, medical staff have to be involved with, this situation dealing head-on with racial injustice, concerns of your players, have you had the time as a head coach to spend on football here in the off season that normally is the biggest part of looking at the off season, but it feels like because of everything else, that's been harder for you guys to get to?
Football is still really a simple game. It's about the organization. It's about the relationships. It's about getting the most out of your young men on a day-to-day basis. And again, not just your players, but your entire staff. I don't know that anybody's reinvented the X's and the O's. We'll be ready for that when it's time. I think dealing with, these very, very important issues of safety and health and systemic issues in our society, these life issues are much more important. And that's what I'm hired for, these much more important issues. I've got a great staff. We'll figure out how to kick out the defensive end and get up inside the C gap. We'll figure that out. These are other issues that need to be handled on a day-to-day basis. And I think I've been properly trained to do that.
It might be a chance for the mission of colleges and universities to reconnect with athletics, as we've seen happen at Notre Dame, especially over these last few years. Year 11 coming up for Brian Kelly, 30 years as a college football head coach. Thanks. We appreciate the time. Hope the family and everybody stays well, and good luck here with phase one and two as the Irish get back to South Bend. Talk to you soon, Brian.
Thanks, Mike. Same to you.
All right, Brian Kelly, head coach of the Notre Dame Fighting Irish. Hopefully we'll be in South Bend in September when Arkansas comes calling for what is an amazing Notre Dame home season. We'll see if it happens. Tom Izzo, national championship coach, joins us as we continue on Lunch Talk Live. Well, Stanley Cup Final Week continues on NBCSN. This is actually fun. I popped into a couple of the 09 Stanley Cup Final games last night. Tonight's the 2010 Stanley Cup Final, so Hawks fans, you'll get to enjoy maybe a little happy hour there, dinner time, and then a little post-game as you watch the cup being raised for the Hawks. The 2010 Stanley Cup Final, Hawks Flyers, NBCSN. We'll be doing that all week long. A man who's a hockey fan, basketball fan, football fan, because you know his lifelong friendship with Steve Mariucci. Tom Izzo, the head coach at Michigan State, joins us here for a little bit. It was really fun when we said goodbye to Brian Kelly and we got to the break. You guys were able to visit for a few minutes there and talk. It is such admiration, I think, that longtime college coaches have for each other because, I mean, you've been there at Michigan State forever. Brian's been at Notre Dame now for 11 years, 30 years as a head coach. I would imagine there's an appreciation for guys who've been in one place for a long time and have been able to kind of survive and thrive in that location.
You know, that's so true, Mike. Don't forget golf, too, because me and you both like golf. So that's another sport we got to make sure we're doing. But
it's true.
You know,
yes, sir.
And watching Brian 11 years at Notre Dame, there's not many people that live 11 years at Notre Dame. So I guess I'm a little more fortunate going in my 38th year here, GA on up. But I do agree with you. You know, I'm on a panel right now that we're trying to look at all these different problems with, you know, Mike Krzyzewski and Jim Boeheim and Roy Williams and, Jay Wright and, of course, Calipari and then Mark Few. And all those guys have been at their places quite a while. Now, I got a ways to go to catch Boeheim and Krzyzewski, but there is a respect factor, football, basketball, any sport. You and your profession. I mean, when you can survive in the public eye in these professions, I think it's not easy as people think to do.
But before we get into the other stuff that's out there, let's just stay with the sport for a second, because I'd love to hear all those coaches that you talked about discussing where the future is. Where's the next 5 or 10 years of college basketball? Because it feels like it's changing every year or so. We don't really know what college basketball is supposed to be. What's the biggest issue in your mind right now that we have to tackle?
Well, I think we've got 3 or 4 that, you know, with the G League coming out now and changing things a little bit. Are they going to start paying players? Are they going to try to get them earlier? Isn't a year or so kids going to come right out of high school and be able to go? The transfer rule has been a big thing for me. I think it's creating some issues. And, then you got the NIL, you know, and how is that going to work and keep some equity in what we're doing is going to be very difficult. So I think we got a lot of things, everybody wants to try to help the student athletes. And yet, you know, sometimes like dealing with your own kids, Mike, you know, what is helping them? What is hurting them? How much do you give them one way and how much do you not give them the other way? You know, me coming from rags to riches, probably you in the same boat. I even wonder that with my own kids. You know, when am I giving them too much? When am I giving them not enough? And that's an ever-ending battle that we all face and we're trying to come to a resolution on.
And for the sport, it's going to need it here for the next 5 years or so. Because you recruit in the city of Detroit so often, you've seen some of the racial injustice, some of the social issues that are really bubbling to the forefront. When you put out your statement on social media last week, I thought it was really powerful. And this is what struck me that maybe you can help educate and we can listen a little bit. You said, as a white American basketball coach who has been trusted and accepted into African-American homes across our country, the racism and injustice I've witnessed has sickened my soul. Can you just discuss what it's like to be on a regular basis welcomed into those homes and hear those stories and see firsthand the hurdles that some of the kids who you recruit are overcoming just to get to that point where Tom Izzo is coming into their living room to talk to them?
Well, it started real early for me, you know, with the guys like Mateen Cleaves and his parents who worked on the lines at, in Flint and did everything. I mean, they really opened their arms up for me, gave me a chance, you know, and I probably wouldn't be sitting in the house I'm in. I probably wouldn't be in the job I'm in because I'm in a sport where there's a lot of times 75, 80% of my players are Black. So because of that, coming from the UP where I came from, Mike, where I played against one Black player in high school. And then I'm in a sport where it's just the opposite. And yet I believe that the first African-American that I met was a guy named Mike Garland, who's now been my assistant for 20 years. You know, we've been, he's my second best friend. You know, Mariucci is my best friend, but Mike Garland is my second best friend. And he taught me so much. The first night on Northern Michigan, he was a year older than me. I went to the gym, and sure enough, who was in there shooting with Mike? He had the big afro. It was unbelievable. And he just came up to me and started talking. And I was a nobody. I was a walk-on, and he embraced me. We became roommates on the road, and that's where my education started. And then, you know, my first recruit was a guy named Steve Smith, who was from Pershing High School, you know, right in the heart of the city. His mother and father were so good to me, and so I have an appreciation. Then to make matters take it to another step, I married a Hispanic woman, and so I got to see it from a little different sides of things. So I, like many, have not done as good a job as I should do in my job, as far as that goes, because sometimes you're afraid to speak up and speak out. But I've learned a lot. I think I've got a lot to give in the next 5 years that I plan on doing even a better job of.
But you've used your voice more than maybe other coaches, to be very honest, because of your success, because of how much you're appreciated. And you have been as recognizable a face in this state, the state of Michigan, for the last 20 years as almost anyone in any walk of life. What is it that a Tom Izzo can do that can help other people listen and understand a little bit more than they have in the past?
Well, what I've been really excited about, Mike, is that when I watched the protests, I've done nothing but watch TV, called former players. I was on the phone hour and a half with Steve Smith the other day. I've been on with Mateen. I've been on with Gregory Kelser. I tried to take different eras of Spartans that I know that I think can help me do a better job. But what can we do? Well, when you watch what's happening, for the first time in all the years that I've watched different things go on, there seems to be a lot more white people involved. And I guess because of the platform I have, you know, I'm one of those. Do we ever do enough? I don't think you ever do enough, but do we got to do more than we've done? That's what I want to be part of. You know, everybody wants to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. It's very cliche to say, but because of how I live at home, because of who I recruit, and because of what I believe in, it is very important to me. And I think that the day in age should come where we're all in this together. I heard a guy talk about it the other day. I think it was Shannon Sharp, and he said, you know, in a locker room, there's differences of opinion, there's different races, there's different ages, especially in the pro locker rooms. But they find a way to all come together, and when they come together, they're of championship quality. I think maybe our country could learn from sports a little bit, and maybe from a locker room, because I think that's very, very important in us making progress ahead. And I don't go into a locker room and say, that player's white and that player's Black. I say, that player can help me win this way, that player can help me win this way, that player can do his job. And then we put it all together, and boy, because of it, you know, we've won a lot of Big Ten championships, and we've been to Final Fours. And so maybe we could all learn from sports. You know, this thing, the pandemic started with sports, Utah. Maybe learning some from that. Maybe the way the systemic problems have been, maybe sports can help a lot. And I think you're starting to see some of that. But I give the credit to people, Mike, out there that have helped a lot. There's getting to be so many people joining in on this. It's almost great to see it.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, you're seeing people who didn't feel a call to be called, and a lot of people listening. And that's a lot of the conversation that needs to be. Hey, before we leave, you had a really interesting comment about what you were doing during the break here and trying to keep yourself busy, that you watched The Last Dance, you watched the Michael Jordan stuff, and you know the Jordan story. And you've got guys who've gone in the league who have been around Michael and played with him. But what was it about seeing all of it together that just kind of struck you as to the message that's there in Jordan's path that can be there for athletes who are not Jordan's ability, but have Jordan desire and those kind of traits as part of their makeup?
Well, listen, Mike, I've had a chance to do a couple things. You know, when I first came here as a GA, Magic Johnson was still coming back here. It was his fifth year in the NBA. And I'd watch how hard he'd work. And then I just was amazed. You know, I said, he's already MVP. He's won a world championship. He works harder than a lot of these guys are trying to get there. I've watched guys like you. I've watched guys in your profession. You know, and I see the number of hours you put in and what you go through. And if there's anything I can learn from the Michael Jordans or the Kobe Bryants, it's that incredible, the Magic Johnsons, incredible work ethic towards a goal. And I think, you know, I hope when I'm done, they say, you know what? He was a guy that cared about people and he was a guy that worked. You know, that's just a simple four-letter word that I think, you know, I don't always work as efficient as I should, but I think you work. And I think when I watched Michael's deal, and I worked his fantasy camp for 5-6 years in Vegas, and he was there every day early in the morning. He was there every night. He was at every function. I mean, I was impressed. You know, I saw some of the negative things that were said about it all. Hey, sometimes, Mike, to be great, you got to make people a little uncomfortable. And I think that's one of the things we can learn in the racism that we're dealing with right now. When I hear people say, you can't be afraid to talk about things that are uncomfortable. You know, when you come from Iron Mountain, Michigan, I mean, some of these things are uncomfortable. But I want to talk about them now. And I think, you know, when you're Michael Jordan and you're trying to win championships, some of those things were uncomfortable. And some of those people might have been offended a little bit. But I'll tell you what, I bet you they enjoyed the rings they're wearing, the experiences they had, and sacrifice is all part of being great. And I think Michael Jordan did it as well as anybody I've ever seen, and I loved it personally.
Yeah, it was cool to watch. Could listen to you talk forever, too. I've seen the work and all your staff and your players. It's just been a remarkable run, and may it keep going. You look great. Glad you're feeling good. Glad you got a little break here, but can't wait to see you back at work. Tom, thanks for joining us. We'll catch up soon, buddy.
Well, Mike, it was a privilege, and take care of your family, and let's all get back on track, and hopefully we'll straighten out the problems that are going on.
You got it. Same here. See you soon. Say hi to everybody. Say hi to my buddy Steven Thompson, who plays on his teams. Great, great young man. When we come back, Kenny Rosenthal is going to join us from The Athletic and MLB on Fox and MLB on Network, and we'll MLB Network, and we'll put him on NBCSN right after this. Okay, Lunch Talk Live continues. So we have a plan for hockey. We have a plan for basketball. We just talked college football. We know that everything else with the NFL is in place to reopen the facilities for the teams. There's the big if over all of it, but at least there's a plan. Baseball, we have no idea. So we had to go to the source, as good as there is, Ken Rosenthal, who does tremendous work for The Athletic, for MLB on Fox, MLB Network, and it's a pleasure to have Ken here on the show. Ken, can you give a Tigers fan hope? Can you give a Padres fan hope? Do you think we're actually going to get a season here?
I do expect, Mike, that there's going to be a season. Now, the question is, what kind of season is it going to be? And I'll try to make this as simple as possible because this stuff makes people's eyes bleed. But essentially, it's down to this. The commissioner, Rob Manfred, has the right to impose a schedule of any length he desires, that the owners desire, as long as he pays the players their pro rata salaries, which is a per game salary. That's what they agreed to in March. And baseball has asked for an additional cut simply because now they know games will be played without fans. The union initially resisted the idea that they could even ask. Now the union is simply saying, we just don't want that to happen. We are already agreeing to pro rata, which is a percentage of what we would have made, and that's where we stand. Now, the other option here, the better option for baseball, mm-hmm. for the union, for fans, is for the two sides to agree and not have a unilateral imposition. And if they agree, they'll agree likely on expanded playoffs, a number of other elements that would hopefully make the game better, make the relationship perhaps even better, because it can't get much worse. And that is where we stand now. The owners made a proposal yesterday. The union is expected to make a counterproposal by tomorrow. And at some point, they have to get going here because time is a-wasting. Essentially, they've proposed Major League Baseball has a 76-game season. Okay, if you want to start a 76-game season and get done by September 27th, which is MLB's goal, you really almost have to get an agreement by the end of this week or early next week.
Ken, you talked about the numbers and the percentage of a cutdown season. Like you said, it can make your eyes water. So I tried to do it simply, and Matt Casey, our producer, helped me put together just a simple graphic for everybody to understand. So if we take the average Major League Baseball salary, and that's $4.4 million coming into this season, you prorated over 76 games, and you mentioned that was kind of negotiated out, and Manfred has the right to do that. That's $2.06 million for that $4.4 million. Then 75% of that, which is the baseball proposal. So the players are looking at, okay, if I make $4.4 million for a 76-game season, I would make $1.55 million. That at least helped me understand a little bit why the players are hesitant and concerned, because there's even another level of that, that if there's no playoffs, if the virus comes right. back, then that $1.5 million, that gets cut by another quarter again. So the players are really trying to protect some sort of income for them for this season.
Yes, and one way around this would be to play a longer season at perhaps some kind of cut, right? Say, let's say, I don't know, 100 games at 75%. But the owners keep saying that they cannot play a large number of games unless the cut is significant. Now, I don't know where the numbers hit the sweet spot for the owners. I'm not even sure where they hit the sweet spot for the players. All I know is the players want their full prorated salary. So where this goes, I'm not sure. Basically, to this point, they've been talking almost different languages, not really making proposals that the other side considers realistic. It's a problem. And at some point, they either get a deal or Manfred imposes a short season, 48, 54 games, somewhere in that range. And that is really not in the best interest of anyone, because then you don't get expanded playoffs. You don't get any of the other things that they're talking about. And what you do get is a grievance from the union, essentially for financial damages. Not a healthy situation.
Right. And it's going to build a bigger chasm between the two sides, which seems pretty large as it is. And to have this fighting in public when people are just trying to fight to keep a job or get back to work does not play well for the entirety of the sport. I want to hit you on two other questions here real quick, Ken, because we're all focused on this. The Major League Baseball draft is tomorrow, and that's cut down out of five rounds. How significant is it to take that draft and shrink it down, you know, when we talk 33rd, 35th round, and just really bang it out after about 160 players?
A lot of ways to look at this, Mike. I believe it's significant, and I believe you're chasing players from your sport. You're perhaps losing that 10th rounder that who knows what he might have been. And maybe he decides to go right. do something else. Now, baseball feels those players are eventually going to be there anyway. They'll go to high school. Well, they'll go to college, graduate high school, go to college, maybe come out another year later. But at the same time, there's a risk. And I don't know that it's a healthy message to send when your sport is fighting for every athlete. So that's one problem with it. The other issue baseball would say is, hey, there's no minor league season this year, almost certainly. So to draft 35, 40 minor league players doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I get that for this season, but there's also talk of reducing the number of minor league teams, which would lead to a reduced draft. That's going to happen, I believe, in future years. But to answer your question, to go five rounds, in my opinion, is not healthy for the sport.
And you mentioned the minor leagues, and that was out there before the pandemic and shrinking the minor leagues, shrinking minor league systems. Does it make sense to have three A-ball level teams and have six teams in your organization? It just feels like as a whole, Ken, all of this is trying to make a significant change to the economic structure of baseball. Is it all small stuff as part of that much bigger goal that Rob Manfred and the owners are trying to get to for 2020 and beyond with this sport?
It's not small stuff, because while the minor leagues are just one element here, there are others. And we've seen this over the years. This is a sport that has taken a data-driven approach in many ways in an effort to become more efficient. Now, there's nothing wrong with that inherently, and often it leads to better outcomes. But at the same time, it has also angered the major league players with the way they've been reduced simply to assets and the way clubs have gone about pre-arbitration, arbitration, free agency. Everything's a math equation now, and it's taken some of the human aspect of it away. And that is part of the reason why players are so angry right now with the clubs and the owners and what they're trying to do here with this additional reduction. They feel that they've given and given and given, actually had it taken and taken and taken, and now they're simply saying enough. So, yes, baseball is trying to become more efficient, always thinking of new ways, and perhaps the minor leagues are one area where efficiency in a greater sense is needed. The question is, how do you go about it, and can you go about it in a way that is perceived as humane? And in the case of the minor leagues, it's part of Americana, right? So it's a delicate balance, and they're struggling to find it.
Yeah, there's multiple stories about those cities who may lose their minor league team, and you realize what that team has meant for generations. We understand progress. We understand a new way to do things, but losing those just touchstones of communities is very hard. So just to come back to the headline here as we wrap up, how long after a deal do you think it'll take to go from, okay, we have an agreement for a schedule and compensation, to first pitch of games that matter? What do you think that time frame looks like, if you can eyeball that?
It's about a month. And that's one reason why baseball already has blown the opportunity that was a golden opportunity to come back on July 4th. It was something that could have just been so great and so well received, been viewed as a healing type of thing, no question. But that's not going to happen. So if there's a deal end of this week, early next week, and I'm being optimistic in saying that, mid-July becomes more realistic, and who knows, it could be August before this is all decided and they're on the field again, in which case you can only play 50, 60 games. So that's how it looks right now. And again, Mike, I wrote this over the weekend. The July 4th blown opportunity really was, in my view, a huge miss. And I understand all the points of view here. I've been covering this for 30 years, hearing about it from both perspectives. Right. But at the same time, there are a few other things going on here in the country. And in this particular environment, at this time, to have this squabble, you would have hoped there would have been some thought of the bigger picture. And yet, it seems like these two sides cannot get out of their own way.
When I read that article and you said that, that just kind of struck me. It's somebody who lives the game and loves it, like my friend Tim Kirkjian, like you, the guys who are just part of baseball and its fabric and its connection with cities and its history. The opportunity's here to help, and it's just not being taken care of. My producer, Matt's going to let me go extra innings so I can ask one more question. When the NFL looked like they were in real dire shape, the last legal issue, the last labor issue, I should say, Jeff Saturday from the Colts, Robert Kraft on the ownership side from the Patriots, they kind of got together and led their sides to this. Are there people in position who can play heroes like that, 11th hour guys to, guys, we have to come together and save the season? Are there people at the table who have the juice to do that in this conversation?
That is a very good question, because obviously the people running the show have yet to, at this point, get a deal. That's the Commissioner Rob Manfred, Deputy Commissioner Dan Halem, Head of the Union Tony Clark, and his top negotiator Bruce Meyer. I don't expect any of them to yield their authority to have a scenario like the one you just described take place. There are others who have been involved in the process in the past in the March agreement. For instance, there were other agents contributing on the player side, but I don't know if we're going to see that type of relationship you just described between an owner and a player occur in Major League Baseball and have that override everything else. I just see the two sides as too centralized for that to happen.
It seems that way with the conversation, just hope against hope. You see him rarely without a bow tie, but he has appeared on national TV now without a bow tie. I hope to hear you back with Joe and John doing your usual great job on baseball and see you on MLB Network as well. We'll keep reading you in The Athletic. Thank you, Kenny, for a few minutes. I really do appreciate and enjoy all your work.
Mike, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Ken Rosenthal, great to have his perspective on the hopes of having a baseball season somewhere here down the line. Back for a final word on Lunch Talk Live, and we'll set the table for Rich Eisen right after this. All right, as we wrap up the show here on Lunch Talk Live, Matt Dumba was scheduled to join us, defenseman for the Minnesota Wild, had an injury last year, came back this year, and some struggles on the ice, came back and played effectively as the Wild were making their push towards the playoffs. He was unable to join us today. Hopefully we'll get to him in the next couple days. He's part of the Hockey Diversity Alliance that seven current and former NHL players announced via social media yesterday. Evander Kane, Akeem Alou, the former NHL player who was involved in many of the conversations that really brought race issues to the forefront of the National Hockey League before New Year's. Among the players, Trevor Daley in there, Wayne Simmonds, Chris Stewart, Joel Ward, and the National Hockey League on their end. Kim Davis, who's the league's senior VP of social impact, points out the group is working independently, but the league is hoping to be able to work with this alliance to try to handle this conversation of race within the National Hockey League's boards effectively and with some impact as well. So hopefully Matt will be able to join us here over our last three shows and we can expand that conversation a little bit. As we've heard from all the sports we've touched with, football, basketball, baseball, there are certainly an awareness issue that has been tackled. Now it's going to be the action issue. And what will the leagues and the teams do beyond money and support, which is significant, but using the platform as well. I mentioned last three shows. We started this show because there were no sports. Sports are now coming back, so we're going to step aside for the good stuff. So three more shows. We hope you join us Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday for the last three shows of Lunch Talk Live, which is elevated to that high level that we now have our own show mug. Thanks for watching. The Rich Eisen Show is next for you here on NBCSN. We'll see you on Wednesday.